Brookside Construction loan to J.P. Morgan Chase. He and the bank discussed taking the unsold units to auction, allowing Chase to write off the remainder of the loan as a loss. For the plan for transformation and Mayor Daley, that was unacceptable. Cabrini Green was too notorious to fail. The city bailed Holston out. He was due to receive a public subsidy of several million dollars only after a certain number of Parkside units were sold. Although the collapse of the housing market left him nowhere near that threshold, the city gave him the money, allowing Chase to renegotiate his loan. A couple of months later, the city financed about half of the $42 million cost to build another 8-story Parkside building on the corner of Oak and Larrabee that would include 39 units of public housing. Most of the owners in Abu and Mark's building were underwater, owing more on their condos than they were worth. Those who bought multiple units, hoping to flip them, were stuck with two apartments they couldn't sell. Neighbors lost their homes to foreclosure. Parkside buyers had been celebrated as urban pioneers and risk-takers. Now they felt like suckers. Owning was supposed to mean you had the right to exercise choices. Buy, sell, move, take out a home equity loan. You wanted to make money, to see a return on your investment. That's what they imagined as the American way. Never mind that the federal government devoted 3 times as much each year to mortgage interest deductions and other homeowner subsidies, essentially public housing for homeowners, than to the entire annual budget of the Department of Housing and Urban Development. But now the housing market had failed them as well. The remaining Cabrini Green high-rises across the street no longer were so easy to ignore. They loomed ominously, like giant tombstones. That was when the public housing families began to move in. Housing officials had talked passionately about the prospect of productive neighboring in the mixed-income developments, the families in public housing networking with and learning from their middle- and upper-class neighbors, working adults modeling a professional lifestyle for lower-income youth. Even in the best of times, it seemed starry-eyed to imagine that interactions would happen in these buildings across race and class and age that rarely occurred elsewhere in the city. But amid the worst financial crisis in 80 years, the divisions became starker. Parkside included on the same floors not only people of different races and classes, but also the conflicting American ideologies of self-sufficiency and social obligation, of home ownership and public assistance. Stuck with their bum mortgages, though, the owners came to resent the people who were living for free beside them in nearly identical apartments. Obsessing over the number of units that sold and at what reduced price, they complained that public housing families were taking over. At their meetings, the condo owners talked endlessly about situations in the building that were depressing their property values. They'd seen renters coming downstairs to get their mail in their pajamas. That wouldn't look attractive to a potential buyer. They proposed a rule prohibiting pajamas in public spaces. They fretted over the congregating of public housing families in the lobbies. They had to be frank. A large gathering of young black people in the entranceway looked more like the old Cabrini Green than a new one. Someone suggested removing furniture from the lobbies. Someone else seconded a rule restricting the size of gatherings inside apartments to keep noise levels down. They complained about public housing residents who left the gates to their townhomes open. It was ugly and a hazard for anyone walking a dog. One woman suggested a ban on garden gnomes. She was afraid no one would buy a place after seeing a gnome. Ansari was especially sensitive to the rising tensions. There were other black condo owners, but the fault lines formed mostly around race. He tried to befriend the older woman who lived next door to them. A former Cabrini Green resident, Miss Smith, told him how much she loved her Parkside apartment and spoke proudly of her son who was attending college. She also played her television at an unbearably high volume, and music with a heavy bass thudded while Abu and Mark tried to sleep. When one of them knocked to mention the noise, Miss Smith apologized and promised to keep it down. But in no time, the music again thumped, and the television again blared, and the requests and the promises were repeated, with increasingly less politeness on both sides. To make matters worse, both Abu and Mark were laid off in the downturn. Ansari was able to find part-time work, but Mark remained at home. Every day, at the same hours, he soon discovered, Miss Smith's adult children visited, often with their own children in tow, and within minutes the family members were screaming at each other. Mark could set his clock by it. He'd try to ignore the yelling, the music, the TV, but he couldn't even think. When he went over to complain, Miss Smith sometimes bemoaned the sorry state of her life, telling Mark that she had nothing and he had everything. Mark couldn't believe it. He was 50 and out of work, with a new mortgage to pay. By then, he'd been unemployed for more than a year, and he worried if he'd ever be hired again. On a night when Mark phoned several times to complain about the racket, one of Miss Smith's sons threatened him, calling him a faggot. Mark had the son banned from the building. The son who'd been away at college returned. "Please, please," he begged of Ansari. "I'm trying to keep the family together." Eventually, though, the manager of the building stepped in, moving Miss Smith to a different Holston development. Mark was overjoyed to see them gone. Ansari's feelings were more mixed. "I felt relief, but also a deep sadness," he'd say. "My biggest nightmare came true." As a black homeowner, he'd forced out a returning Cabrini Green resident. The Smiths certainly weren't uplifted by their brief time in Parkside of Old Town. The economy began gradually to improve. Mark found a full-time job. Slowly, the empty Parkside condo sold. You couldn't beat the location, at the crossroads of major boulevards and bus and train routes, right by the loop and the burgeoning tech sector forming nearby in River North. The hulking Montgomery Ward warehouse hugging the river just a couple of blocks away had been remade with the use of city subsidies and now included high-end condos, corporate headquarters, restaurants, a spa, and a yacht club with boat slips onto the water. Ground was broken on another park side of Old Town Midrise, as well as on several other private residential buildings in the immediate vicinity. Demolition of the remaining Cabrini Green high-rises proceeded. The CHA renter who moved into Miss Smith's apartment was a widowed grandfather who kept to himself. Every once in a while, Abu and Mark could hear, as if at a distance, the tinkling of contemporary jazz. They worried mostly that they were too loud for him. Dolores Wilson. Most of the high-rises at the city's other large public housing developments were already leveled or in the process of being cleared. It seemed to defy reason that the most infamous of Chicago's gallery-style public housing complexes, the one on the primest real estate, would outlast them all. But the lawsuits at Cabrini Green had stalled demolition. Now it raced to catch up. 5 white high-rises were raised over 13 months, starting in December 2005. 1340 North Larrabee, 630 West Evergreen, 714 West Division, 534 West Division, and 624 West Division. Kelvin Cannon had lived in 2 of the buildings as a child. Then came 1121 North Larrabee and 1159 to 1161 North Larrabee, 2 of the Reds. And in a flurry, in 2008, 5 more of the Red high-rises, a total of 538 apartments. Dolores Wilson watched as one by one the white high-rises around her were crowned with the rooftop billboard that heralded their demise. "Hennigan Wrecking, we make space." And then she couldn't look away as the space was made. The red-cabbed cranes came in, a wrecking ball the size of an ocean liner's anchor swinging into the top floors. The prefabricated facade crumbling like old chalk. Another crane with steel teeth spat water as it tore into a wall, exposing someone's room behind it. Bit by bit, the buildings disappeared. one apartment, a bank of them, several floors. The sheared towers revealed dozens of brightly painted rooms, like a box of pastels. When the letter arrived saying 1230 North Burling would be next, the high-rise facing it was in the process of being reduced to a couple of 25-foot mounds of rubble. A group of residents in Dolores' building met in the first-floor rec room to decide what to do. One of the elected tenant reps warned everyone about the CHA scare tactics. Kenneth Hammond, a 41-year-old lifelong Cabrini resident, had been living in an adjacent high-rise, and when it was torn down, he'd leaped as if from a sinking ship to the Burling building. Hammond had watched as his former neighbors took whatever far-flung addresses the housing agency assigned them. They were made to believe they didn't have a choice, and most of them ended up in neighborhoods that seemed at least as poor and segregated and violent as the homes they'd left. "Don't think it's near safe out there as it is in your own community," Hammond cautioned. Cabrini Green had its problems, of course, but it was better to face those problems in your own home than on someone else's turf. Living at Cabrini, most people had figured out which stores offered credit, what church, social service agencies, community leaders, and neighbors could be counted on in a bind. If someone had trouble with rent, a towed car, or a family member who'd been arrested, she at least knew where to find help. In the private market, you were on your own. "Who can you go to?" Hammond said. "Once you're in these new communities, they're going to shut you out. Only thing they're going to tell you, man, shorty, go back to where you used to stay. The CHA trying to set us up to fail." The last thing Dolores wanted to do was move. At 81, after a half century at Cabrini Green, she had her church, her friends, her family, all on the near north side. Her youngest son, Kenny, had passed away a couple of years earlier, of pneumonia. But both of her daughters lived in 1230 North Burling as well. Debbie on the same floor and Cheryl two floors up, on the eighth. Dolores appreciated that people wanted to fight to stay. "Carol Steele works her butt off," she said. "Praise the Lord for her. I'm glad she doesn't give up." But in her conscientious way, Dolores attended the relocation meetings. She filled out the surveys and paperwork and followed up with a case manager. She had zero interest in testing the private market after all her years in public housing. She'd heard about families renting with vouchers who'd been forced to relocate two and three times. She didn't think she could handle one move, let alone more. She walked across Division Street to Parkside of Old Town and submitted an application for a unit. When she visited one of the apartments there and stepped out onto the balcony, she lurched back. The fence between her and a six-flight fall was no more than waist high. "I got conditioned where I can walk up to a fence and lean against it, even if it looks like a prison," she explained of the ramps and the high-rises. But she knew Peter Holston and respected the way he ran a building. A woman at the Parkside office told Dolores, "We'll let you know." But no one ever did. She turned in an application at the Cabrini Row houses as well. At least she could have a front and back door, a little yard. But the manager there blew her off, telling her to come back Friday, and then didn't show himself. Eventually, a representative from the CHA told her to choose somewhere else. She joined a scheduled tour of the rehabbed public housing across the city, a carload of residents leaving from in front of her building. Dolores liked what she saw at Lawndale Gardens, a row home development on the west side, in the Little Village neighborhood. But then she found out it was a block away from the Cook County Jail, with its 10,000 inmates. "I can't be close to a jail," she shouted. It would have been like someone who believed in ghosts living alongside a cemetery. She'd have heard the suffering of the inmates at all times. They drove her next to the Dearborn Homes, on the south side, once a part of the four-mile corridor of public housing that stretched south from the loop along State Street. Dolores was tired of running around, so she took it. Her unit there would be a tiny one-bedroom on the fifth floor of a 9-story building. The CHA set it up so Cheryl could relocate to an apartment on the same floor. Even for someone as meticulous as Dolores Wilson, the actual move was confusing. She had so much in her 4-bedroom apartment to pack, and so little space in her new place to put it. She was told she would be given boxes for all her belongings. Then on the day of the move, the men from Big O Movers said there weren't any more boxes, and they had to move her right away. Dolores cried as a lifetime of mementos went into the trash. She lost every letter she ever received. She lost her wedding photos and pictures from her trips to Jamaica with Hubert, and documents from her time as head of the resident management group. Hubert had received more than 20 certificates and awards for coaching sports teams and running his drum and bugle corps. The Corsairs had won 26 trophies. Dolores had honors from HUD, the Chicago Police, the Water Department. All that history was gone. Every plaque tossed in a city dump somewhere. "I hate Daly Jr. with a passion," Dolores would say. She blamed him for doing nothing when he was Cook County State's attorney, and the news broke about John Burge, the Chicago police commander who supervised the torture of more than 100 black men. She blamed Daly for caring more about the land at Cabrini Green than the people who lived there. And she blamed him now for the loss of her belongings. Kelvin Cannon. When Kelvin Cannon's first 3-year term as tenant council president ended, the CHA extended it to 5 years without holding an election. With the foreclosure crisis and the plan for transformation stalled, the agency must have felt justified in ignoring this isolated little fief in the democratic process. Cannon didn't question why 2 years were added to his term. He just went ahead and did his job the best he could. He met with developers to go over the constantly reduced scope of their plans. Hundreds of landlords in the city renting to Section 8 families were also losing their buildings to foreclosure, sending their tenants back into the private housing market at a perilous time. Many of these Cabrini families were now calling their old home, asking Cannon for assistance. J.R. Fleming, in his role with the Coalition to Protect Public Housing, sometimes harangued Cannon, accusing him of cozying up to the developers. But all in all, Cannon believed he'd been among the fairest, most loyal tenant council presidents ever at Cabrini Green. He was proud of the work he'd done. Yet in 2010, when Carol Steele pressed for an election, he decided not to run. With the construction of the first phase of Parkside completed and the rest slowly beginning to resume, Cannon felt it was time to move on. He lived in 1230 North Burling since 1983, when he was paroled there. In 2010, the tenants were told the building would be torn down, and Cannon moved into an apartment in Parkside of Old Town. It was a 2-bedroom, with 2 bathrooms and a balcony that looked onto his emptying Burling high-rise. The apartment had a sunny, open design, hardwood floors covering the connected kitchen and living room, and carpeting in the bedrooms. There were stainless steel appliances and a granite countertop, and it was roomy enough for Cannon to put a weight bench alongside his couch. He hung his panther paintings. His photograph collection covered the walls, the tabletops, and an upright glass display case, the pictures telling his life story. Cannon in a group shot with his children, or alongside his father during a prison visit, or dressed to the nines at the players' ball, or standing beside Mayor Daly, or with Reginald and William Blackman when they were teenagers. Cannon's oldest brother stayed in the 2nd bedroom. Cannon's mother and another brother also moved into a Parkside unit. People griped that Cannon had gotten the apartments as payback for his support of the developers and the city. But he dismissed that talk as plain jealousy. He applied for an apartment and qualified just like anyone else. "I can't help that we passed drug tests and background checks and others didn't," Cannon said. And of course he looked out for his mother. She was 80. If I don't help my mother, who will? For Cannon, living in Parkside was a blessing. You're supposed to pass that blessing on to the next person, he said. So he understood why others complained about it. By year 10 of the plan for transformation, and with almost every high-rise gone, only 372 Cabrini Green families had moved into a mixed-income development. Those applying were excluded from one of the limited spots if they or a family member couldn't pass a criminal background check, if they had unpaid rent or utility bills, if they or any adult on the lease failed the drug test, or if they weren't working 30 hours a week, or their children weren't enrolled in school. Halston estimated that he accepted one of every 5 public housing applicants, but it turned out that a small number actually applied. They assumed mixed income wasn't for them. Of the 60 Cabrini families Halston had asked to compete for 12 units in Northtown Village, only 2 saw the process through. He began working with church leaders and local officials to bring out more potential tenants. He hired William Gates, the former prep school basketball star featured in the documentary Hoop Dreams, and a longtime row house resident. An ordained minister, Gates conducted outreach for Halston in the Cabrini community. Cannon knew some Cabrini families at Parkside who felt that the old public housing, for all of its faults, had been more hospitable. In their new mixed-income buildings, they had to undergo regular housekeeping checks, and there were fines for such things as riding a bike on the sidewalk or playing loud music from a car. There was a sense you could get in trouble just for being yourself. When anyone on a public housing lease did mess up, and he or she was arrested, even for a misdemeanor, even if the arrest didn't lead to a conviction, the entire family could be evicted. Many times the CHA struck a deal with a leaseholder, saying she could stay only if the arrested family member was barred from ever setting foot in the apartment. You might have felt like you won the lottery when you got into Parkside, but now you had to choose between your daughter who was caught smoking weed and a roof over your head. In Cannon's building, you'd smell weed coming from some of the condo owners' apartments. They weren't drug tested. They kept dogs and barbecued, but public housing families weren't allowed to do either. Cannon didn't want a dog himself, and he didn't mind the drug tests or the inspections. He believed rules were necessary to keep order, and his market-rate neighbors had paid for certain privileges. Different laws for different tenants, though, didn't do much for fostering productive neighboring. The public housing families in the new buildings weren't allowed to form tenant councils, but the owners had their condo associations, and they set the rules that affected everyone. In any condo building in the city, owners were going to be wary of large numbers of renters. Renters didn't have savings tied up in the property and had no financial stake in the building's future. That wariness was even greater at Parkside, since the renters paid only a small subsidized rent. Imagining himself an ambassador, Cannon took it upon himself to bridge that divide, greeting what he called his European neighbors. He'd say, "Good morning," and "Good evening." Sometimes people ignored him. But if he saw them later in the Seward Park Fieldhouse or the stores across Division Street, they smiled with a flash of recognition. That was a start. Occasionally, people in the building responded by welcoming him to the neighborhood, not considering that they were new and he'd been there for close to 50 years. Annie Ricks. In November 2010, the woman from the Chicago Housing Authority phoned again, pleading, begging Annie Ricks to please move somewhere. She told Ricks it wasn't safe to live alone like that in the projects. 15 stories, 134 units, the entire 1230 North Burling building a pillar of darkness save for 7 remaining families. At night, the glow from the Ricks' windows in apartment 1108 looked like the distant beacon of a lighthouse. With a laugh, Ricks told the official to let her be. She'd lived at Cabrini Green for 21 years, and she was going to enjoy her Thanksgiving at home. "You have to find a new home, Miss Ricks." No, I don't. I can stay in 1230 North Burling forever. One of the tenant reps in the building told Ricks, I'm not going until you go. But then he left for the row houses. He ran like a chicken with its head cut off, Annie said. When the moving trucks came for the last seven families, only Ricks and a man on a lower floor refused to leave. Then he relented, taking an apartment assigned to him. By that wintry fall, Cabrini Green's 22 other towers had each been shuttered. Ricks was the last tenant of all the Cabrini Green high-rises. She was also the last remaining resident of any gallery-style public housing high-rise in Chicago. Every tower had been closed. Tens of thousands of families packed up and moved elsewhere. She'd outlasted them all. At 54, Ricks was a grandmother, nearly 40 times over. She'd lost all her teeth except for two on the bottom, and her black hair was streaked with white. I'm the last woman standing, she liked to proclaim. A CHA relocation specialist had taken Ricks to see Lawndale Gardens, not far from where she grew up on the west side. But she had memories of coming home from Harrison High School and running from the Mexican and Puerto Rican students who threatened to beat her up. She didn't want that for her children or grandchildren. She went to check out the Cabrini row houses as well. Doesn't this area seem right to you, Miss Ricks? A housing official asked her. It didn't. Of the 600 homes there, just 150 of them, a sliver along Cambridge Avenue, had been rehabbed. The other 450 had been cleared of residents in 2008 and left to sit, even though the plan for transformation promised that the entire area would be fixed up and repopulated. Column after column of the barracks-style homes remained empty, their doors and first-floor windows covered in boards, their postage-stamp gardens gone to field, the perimeters blocked off with chain-link fencing, like some military outpost long after the soldiers left for home. Annie knew, too, that the boys in the row houses were warring with the young guys from the Orange Doors, the Evergreen Terrace apartments on Sedgwick, north of Division Street. Two of her former students had been shot on Cambridge. A pro bono lawyer suggested that Ricks agree to move into the best of the replacement homes being offered. But she decided she wouldn't accept anything less than a four-bedroom apartment, which was what she was eligible for. She wasn't illegal in her apartment. She paid her rent on time. No one caught her with drugs or guns. So how could the CHA just assign her a new apartment? There were six people on her lease. Three of her children, Reggie, Rose, and Raquan, two of her grandkids, and herself. For 20 years, Ricks had lived in a four-bedroom in a neighboring high-rise, 660 West Division. Then in 2008, when that building was about to be torn down, movers with the Housing Authority carried out all her belongings and set her up in 1230 North Burling. In her Burling apartment, she had five bedrooms and a big living room, with a closet that fit an air mattress for whenever another family member needed to spend the night. She'd bought a brand new washing machine from Home Depot less than a year before, thinking she'd be able to use it in her new apartment for years to come. If she had to move, she wanted a unit that also had a washing machine hookup. Why lie and say they don't have a four-bedroom at the CHA? She'd complain, citing a litany of dates and detailed conversations she'd had with housing officials. I know they have a four-bedroom. They have so many four-bedrooms over there. She cut herself short, a look of surprise giving way to a wide, close-mouthed smile. But I can never be mad. Alone in 1230 North Burling, she decided to turn the solitude into a celebration. In her apartment, she cranked the music all the way up. Power and Praise on AM 1390. No one else was left in the building to complain. Her daughter Rose and several of her grandchildren jumped rope in the apartment. The younger ones hula-hooped and pogo-sticked. Ricks fired up the grill and barbecued on the open-air gallery. An icy gale sliced through the fencing, 11 stories high, but she repeated to anyone who would listen that she didn't mind one bit. As much as Rix professed her love of living alone in 1230 North Burling, it took its toll. One Sunday, she returned from church to find a river gushing outside her apartment. She grabbed a broom and attacked the water, whisking it off the ramp and elevator. She traced the source into the vacant apartment next to hers, the stream leading into one of the bathrooms. A bathtub had been stopped up, the taps turned on full blast. Sabotage, she cursed. Now they were trying to flood her out. And it wasn't easy clambering up the stairwells, hiking those 11 stories. She wasn't young like she used to be, and the elevators didn't always work. The elevator was often broken in 660 West Division, but there she lived on the 5th floor and could drop in and see family members on the way up. At 1230 North Burling, nobody else was left to invite her in for a visit. On December 1st, 2010, the CHA took Rix to court, seeking an emergency injunction to close her building. The agency argued that it was not only absurd, but also an undue financial burden to keep the heat on in a 15-story high-rise with just a single unit occupied. A federal judge agreed. Rix had to leave within 10 days. Annie said she would move if she could go across the street, into Parkside of Old Town. But the housing authority deemed it unfair for the Rix family to skip ahead of the many Cabrini residents on the Parkside waiting list. And maybe the agency considered Annie Rix too obstinate, too intractable, for the delicate balance of mixed-income living. They gave her a unit 7 miles south, in Wentworth Gardens, a low-rise public housing development of 422 units, sandwiched between the 14 lanes of the Dan Ryan Expressway and the fenced parking lots for the White Sox baseball stadium. When she toured Wentworth earlier that fall, she saw teenagers and young men selling drugs out in the open. She didn't know these young men. At Cabrini, she had known all the boys who lingered outside her high-rise. She likely helped raise them in the after-school programs she ran, or in the classrooms in which she worked as a teacher's aide. She'd probably shared meals with them or their families. Her lawyer explained to the judge that Rix was afraid to live at Wentworth Gardens. But the judge said drugs were being sold all over Chicago. That was that. I had to go, she'd concede. Either that or be homeless. On the morning of her move out of Cabrini Green, December 9th, 2010, Rix rose early to take her bath. It was 21 years almost to the day since she'd walked there in a snowstorm. As she readied herself, Rix pulled her hair back into a sprig of a ponytail. She put on a white-collared shirt with gray stripes and a caramel-colored leather coat. Annie and her children had been up most of the night finishing the packing. On the way out of the building for the last time, Rix stuck her head into the management office. Kenneth Hammond and a couple of other tenant representatives were in there. "Hey, y'all, I'm leaving," she said. She passed by the building's janitors, gathered on the ground floor. Her new apartment in Wentworth Gardens didn't have a laundry hookup. She'd given away her new washing machine to a janitor who'd looked out for her. He and his brother had already carted it off. "I'm gonna miss you," Rix told him. "I'll miss you too," he said. As it had the day she arrived at Cabrini Green, snow had fallen. But this time, the reporters really did show up to chronicle her move. They were there from ABC, NBC, CBS, Fox, WGN, The Tribune, The Sun-Times, The New York Times, The Wall Street Journal. An inglorious end to an infamous era, as one of the newspapers put it. Another described Cabrini Green as the housing development that came to symbolize the squandered hope of them all. The reporters jostled around the last high-rise tenants of what had been the city's, and really the country's and the world's, most iconic public housing complex. Rose Rix, then 17, rolled a suitcase with a Route 66 sticker on it. She said, I've been here basically my whole life. Like, it's hard leaving when you've got so much memories of it. You know everyone. You felt safe. Men from Big O Movers carried out most of the belongings, but Annie didn't trust them with her most prized possessions. Her son, Deonta, lugged a cardboard box filled with the trophies he and his siblings had won for basketball tournaments and perfect attendance, and the one that he took home for being valedictorian of the school that was still there, just an empty field away. Schiller had been given a new name and a makeover, and it reopened the year before, serving only those students who tested in, ranking it among the best elementaries in the entire state. Children no longer walked a few hundred feet to get there, but arrived by car and school bus. Deonta stopped outside the high-rise. He wanted people to understand that Cabrini Green was more complicated than they thought. There was the myth of the place as something terrifying. You said you were from Cabrini Green, and people recoiled, as if you had a deadly disease they might catch. But living at Cabrini, the Ricks family had experienced the fullness of it. They also had fun there. There was more good there than bad, he tried to explain. When the trophies were stowed and the furniture loaded onto a truck, Annie Ricks ducked into a sedan the same off-white color as her high-rise. The car spun its wheels on the snow, gained traction, and she was gone. 16. They came from the projects. That was December 2010. By March, the last Cabrini Tower had been stripped of every window, door, and cabinet. The steel curtains covering the ramps were yanked off and carted away. The 15-story high-rise looked exposed, like a giant dresser without any drawers. On a frigid evening, 100 people huddled in the field below. They were gathered to commemorate the end. The demolition of 1230 North Burling would begin in the morning. Behind the crowd, to the east, in the real estate running to the Gold Coast and Lake Michigan, the sunset played off the glass and steel towers. Above them, the twilight passed through the skeleton of the Burling building. They could also see a man inside the tower, his movements revealed by the yellow vest he wore and the horn of light extending from his head. There he was, alone in what might have been a friend's apartment. And now he was on one of the upper floors, beneath ceiling fans sent whirling by the wind. His name was Jan Tiki, and he was a conceptual artist and professor at the School of the Art Institute of Chicago. On his commute to the Art Institute in recent years, he'd passed the infamous housing project, witnessing the late stages of its erasure. Tiki's art tended to wrestle with architecture as a site of social and political conflict, and he proposed to the CHA a live art installation in the last Cabrini high-rise. It would be a way to memorialize the disappearing icon. To his surprise, officials at the agency loved the idea. For his Project Cabrini Green, Tiki partnered with local after-school programs, and their students contributed poems about the housing development. Jada Jones wrote in Trapped, "What they called hell, we had named home. On the streets where children were once found, transformed by evening to brutal battlegrounds, that's where we belonged." Tiki recorded the students reading their words, and he translated the syncopations of their voices into flashes of light, blinkering LED circuits that he placed inside 134 ammo boxes painted a bright orange, one box for each 1230 North Burling apartment. Tiki planned for the lights to run on a loop throughout the 30-day demolition, or until they were destroyed by the wrecking ball. All of this would be filmed from a camera set up on a balcony of one of the parkside of Old Town Apartments across Division Street. Dual images, along with audio of the children reading their poems, would play simultaneously on a website and at the Museum of Contemporary Art, just a mile east of the building. It seemed only fitting that the passing of high-rise Cabrini Green would be turned into art and idea. The development had long existed in both its solid state of concrete and steel, and in the vaster realm of abstraction, evoked as shorthand to convey a certain idea of the inner city. Just 3 weeks earlier, a primetime network crime drama called The Chicago Code aired an episode it named Cabrini Green. Ronan Gibbons, a character on the Fox series played by Delroy Lindo, is a Cabrini Green native who has lifted himself up to become both alderman and syndicated crime boss. The real-life alderman of the neighborhood, the Cabrini native with a bank robbery in his past, Walter Burnett, joked about any likeness. "You know that character grew up in Cabrini. It's insulting. At least give me some kind of royalty." In voiceover, Gibbons describes his childhood at the near Northside housing project, how people deteriorated along with the high-rises, personal squalor matching that of the physical environment. "I made it my mission to see that prison torn down," he says, as the episode chronicles, with surprising accuracy, the many ways the city's public housing went wrong. The lack of funding, the loss of rent-paying residents, the 18,000 people living on 70 acres, more than two-thirds of them children. The demolition of Cabrini Green, Gibbons goes on, showed me there was hope. Hope that a kid from the streets could rise up and be an instrument of change. As we hear his soliloquy, we watch a murder that Gibbons has ordered on another black kid from the streets, someone who happened to cut into his profits. In the city's churn, the war on anything considered blight, there are always going to be winners and losers. "Today is a great day," the alderman declares, "the first day of a better Chicago." Some of those at the vigil outside 1230 North Burling that night shared the sentiment of the fictional alderman, believing that the event marked the end of a failed 50-year public enterprise, a long-overdue exorcism of inner-city horrors. "This is really the final high-rise," a CHA official who joined the ceremony announced triumphantly. "The legacy with the gallery-style public housing? It's a final farewell." Photographers for the National Public Housing Museum, which was still struggling to raise funds to open its museum of stories and ideals on the site of the former Jane Addams homes a couple of miles south, were out there capturing the moment. So, too, were crew members from the Cabrini Green documentary, 70 Acres in Chicago. One of them lowered a boom mic in front of another CHA employee who was describing the deal the agency had struck that week with the retailer Target to build a 190,000-square-foot store on the site of the cleared William Green homes. He said the Target would bring jobs to the Cabrini Green residents who remained in the row houses and the surrounding mixed-income buildings. But many residents didn't see the trade-off as a net gain. "People get dispersed for a Target?" a tenant leader asked, his voice going high-pitched with incredulity. "All of this?" He swept his arms, taking in the expanse of empty land where thousands of people had lived. "For a Target?" As night fell, Jan Tiki was still moving through the tower, rechecking that the boxes housing the LEDs were fastened tightly to whatever secure things he could find in the stripped apartments. Electrical outlets, light sockets, heating pipes. Most everything in the units had been removed, though traces of the lives spent there remained. A painting of a black dreadlocked Jesus. An elaborate mural of a giant Bugs Bunny alongside a wizardly Mickey Mouse and a whirling Tasmanian devil. Each of the characters holding blunts the size of their arms, their heads in clouds of smoke, and eyes crenellated in red. In a bedroom, a single piece of white paper was still taped to the cinder block. It was a list scrawled in red marker. The 7 keys to success. Among them, set and achieve goals, make wise choices, and be persistent. In another apartment, a green and gold mural covering an entire wall stated, "I need money." While the people in the parking lot below waited for the start of Project Cabrini Green, the marching band from the Marion Nzinga Stamps Youth Center arrived. The flag-waving majorettes stepped crisply heel to toe, the tack-tack-clap of the drums and cymbals ringing the air. The dancers spun as a boy on drums shouted a command. Everyone in the brigade dropped low, their bent legs swaying like butterfly wings. Then the LEDs started dancing from the cavities of the high-rise. It was like stealing a peek inside 134 still-occupied homes, nighthawks in each, planted in front of a television, the flickering sets washing the darkened rooms in their glow. Annie Ricks. For a couple of weeks, the media followed Annie Ricks and her family to Wentworth Gardens, eager to tell the next chapter in the life of the last Cabrini-Green high-rise tenant. Annie's new apartment was on the second floor of a three-story walk-up, part of attached buildings that formed a horseshoe around a shared courtyard. During the news interviews, the boys who hung outside tried to angle their way into the camera shots as Rose Ricks shooed them away. "My family from Cabrini-Green made history," Annie would proclaim.
"We made nationwide history."
But the attention waned, and the reporters stopped calling. Annie's 20-year-old son, Reggie, liked to tease her, nodding his elastic face as he addressed his mother by her middle name.
"You used to be popular, Jeffrey."
"I am popular, Reggie Lee Ricks," she chided playfully. "God loves me."
Like many of the people who relocated elsewhere, Ricks regularly traveled back to Cabrini-Green. She was one of those gathered outside 1230 North Burling on the eve of its demolition. Her daughter Latasha drove her, and her son Kenton snapped photos as Ricks watched roosting geese and a rabbit scurry over the cleared fields. On other days, she spent time with family members in the remaining row houses. She'd drop into Carol Steele's office or track down Joe Peary in his Parkside of Old Town building. At the end of the school day, her son Raquan usually took the bus, not to Wentworth, but to Cabrini-Green, playing basketball at Seward Park. Some relocated parents enrolled their children in Jenner or Manier, another local elementary, having them ride a bus and train rather than put them in schools in their new neighborhoods. Others met up with friends at the row houses, hanging on Cambridge. Better there than an unfamiliar strip of Austin, Englewood, or South Shore. At a town hall meeting for those displaced by the plan for transformation, former Cabrini residents talked about the dangers in their unfamiliar neighborhoods. "My grandchildren can't even go outside and play in their so-called new community since they received their Section 8 apartment," a woman told the crowd at St. Joseph's. "They are having gang wars all around this city when a new face comes on the block. So that is why my grandchildren come back to Cabrini to play with the people they know and the people who know them." Former residents also